Are you an improviser looking for a more honest approach to your improv? Or are you just new to improv? Or are you an actor who's always wanted to do improv but was afraid to try? Well, I've got some great news for you. And it's only a 3-hour workshop, so it's not a huge time or money commitment. I will be offering my Intro to Artist Low Comedy 1-day workshop on Saturday, October 13th here in Chicago. I limit this to 14 people, so you'll get personal attention. For more information or to sign up, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Also, if you're a seasoned improviser or actor and you live in the Chicagoland area and you want to take your improv to the next level and you have a little more time to commit, then I'd love it if you could take my Artist Low Comedy Level 1 class. It starts on Wednesday, October 31st. It runs for 6 weeks, and I limit this to only 14 people as well. For more information, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Oh, hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Derek Miller. He is a master improviser, teacher, and actor. He's done tons of TV commercials, and he's been a regular on 3 shows. Derek's been a mainstay of the L.A. improv community for a very long time. He was part of the cast at Io West's opening night, the improvised musical. And we caught up with him in Chicago before he moved to England and talked to him about how the L.A. improv scene has changed over the years, how doing a boat for Second City helped his career, how he uses a suggestion in a long form. We also do some exercises. He shows us how he uses emotions in his work, and why he's leaving Los Angeles to go to England. This is kind of a longer episode, so I am going to spare any story about myself. It's just great to be back and having an episode for you. So here it is. Enjoy it. It is so helpful. It was very helpful for me, especially this stuff about emotions. Here it is, the Derek Miller episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah.
Derek Miller, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge improv nerd. I'm so excited to be here. This is fantastic.
That's great. Yeah. You grew up splitting time between 2 Chicago suburbs, mm-hmm. Homewood, Flossmoor, and Wilmette. Yeah. And just for the listeners, we're in your dad's house now.
Yeah, we're up on the North Shore at the moment. Yeah, it's nice.
And you were in theater and improv at an early age. And in high school, your theater teacher would actually ask you to sub. Right?
Yeah, well, he'd let me sub. Yeah, when there wouldn't ever need a sub, I was such a huge improv nerd that he let me take over the class, and I would teach improv for that period while he was gone.
And what kind of stuff did you learn, or what were you teaching the class?
It was mostly like, you know, theater sports games, like Spolony kind of stuff, and, you know, some stuff that was a little more gamey. But it was a blast, and I think everybody else really dug it. And they'd always have to have another substitute there to watch. You know, like, but they loved it because, like, a free period, they could just sit and watch, and they'd be laughing to them, like, oh, this is kind of cool.
And at, you know, like 15, 16, 17, how did you learn those games?
I did, like, community theater down in Flossmoor and stuff growing up. And then when I got to high school, I went to Interlochen, and then
Tell us about Interlochen. Was an art school.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Interlochen Art School. It's a camp in northern Michigan, and it's just like a dream. It's like you show up, and you're like, oh, these are my people, you know. It's like for the first time you're surrounded by the most talented artist children in the country and the world. You know, I had kids from Venezuela in my cabin and Italy.
And it's a real honor to get in there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I got in. I was like the least talented person there. But, man, it was so eye-opening, and it showed me how much devotion and passion people had. And I got to do some visual art, and it was just so eye-opening.
And were you exposed to improv there?
I was. There was another kid from Chicago who'd done a bit more, and he had a little group, and we went and played. And I did little skits I recorded with Tim Nordwin, who's now in OK Go. We made all these little video bits I just found.
OK Go is a
rock band.
OK, great.
Yeah. So
I'm a little older than you are, so I had a rock band.
So they were all those guys were in my cabin, OK Go, and Jewel was there at the time.
Jewel
of? The singer, Jewel. Uh-huh. Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people kind of came out.
What was she like?
I didn't get to meet her, but her the guys that ended up being in her band were in my cabin. So, like, her bass player and everybody else. So, it's cool.
And then from there, you go on to Indiana University, and you join the improv group there.
Yeah, I actually started a group with a girl, Jill Benjamin, who went to high school with me at HF.
Who actually did a show called Hiccups and
Hiccups with Seth Meyers. Yep. So after college, well, Jill and I both did speech team in high school, and we were both super into comedy and got to do some fun experimental stuff at HF. And then when we got to college together, I remember I just went down there last weekend. I'm having this very wistful trip through the Midwest right now. And I took a picture in the parking lot where we decided that day to start an improv group. And we started a group that became Full Frontal Comedy, and they'll be 25 years next year.
So you were one of the original members of Full Frontal.
Yeah, Jill and I, and then another guy named Matt Hahn who worked at the union board. And then it kind of blew up from there. Nicole Parker was in that group, and then Norm Thoming, who performs with me in L.A., and a whole host of other really talented people. But Jill and I, just kind of had this idea, and it's been going and going. It's cool.
How do you feel about that?
I love it. There was an article that we found, too, that was from the paper, and it was like, in it, I was quoted. I'm like, well, I would just like this group to go on for 10 years. And then we hit the 10-year mark, and it was like, oh, that's cool. Now it's 25. So the legacy of it's pretty great. And the kids from that group, in the last few years, I'd have them fly out to L.A., and I'd give them, like, the improviser dream spring break. And they'd get to have classes with Bill Cott and Rosowski and Brian O'Connell and everybody who's teaching at all the theaters in L.A., and guys from The Groundlings, Stephanie Courtney, and everything. So they had a nice swath of all the improv stuff. It was like the dream improviser vacation. So I got to know some of the younger kids pretty well, and they've been matriculating and coming out to LA.
Why is that important? Because you're a very, very successful actor, 100 commercials, 3 regular series, and a regular series, a series regular, I think is what they call it in LA. Why is it important for you to mentor the people that are coming up behind you?
I think it's because it's like it is such a, you know, just like everything in improv is an oral tradition, and there's no real structure. Even in Hollywood, there's no structure to anything. There's no like graduated program of like, you're on to the next level. You know, it's like everything's ebbing and flowing. So to kind of have somebody else there to help you out, like it's everything I wish I would have had, like when I came to LA or before I came to LA, just to kind of help them and just kind of give them stuff that I never really had. And so many people have now helped me out through once I did get to Los Angeles that I think it's kind of my way of giving back. There's a lot of friends who have really gone out of their way for me and so many opportunities opened up. And I think that's kind of, you know, they always talk about Hollywood being very nepotistic, and that's kind of, I guess, my own way of doing it. Every show I've worked on, I've managed to get friends on the show or whatever. Like, I always try to do that.
And the other thing I admire about you, you had this confidence. So when you're in Indiana, you're like, you're reading about how to do the Herald, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Truth and Comedy. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm going to get Del Close. So you get on the phone and you bring Del Close to Indiana University.
Well, actually, we came up here, but I just cold called I.O. And I was like, yeah, we want to take a workshop with Del. So, and they're like, I think we talked to Sharna. She's like, okay, we'll set it up. It costs this much and show up at this time. And we all drove up from Indiana. And we got to do that a few times. So we got to work with Del. But we knew how special it was. But in hindsight, I can't believe how cool it was that we got to do that.
How did that experience working with Del inspire you?
I think, you know, it's the energy and the kind of how much we got kind of called on stuff or pushed into weird zones to kind of like develop voice. And I think a lot of that's kind of lost today in some degree, especially in Los Angeles training. You know, there's curriculum and all this stuff, and there's not so much there to develop who you are as a person, you know, like kind of pushing it in that way. So I look back on that stuff as like, you know, whatever he was reading in the paper or just kind of the room was very alive, you know, and I remember exercises and things that he did and I can regurgitate those. But I think overall there was a, you know, like a weird off, you know, like everybody was kind of off their footing, you know, so everybody was kind of forced to do stuff in new and interesting ways.
Can you go into more detail about finding your voice?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the most important thing I've been looking back at, and especially what I tried to do was when I started teaching outside of the curriculums of IO and Second City, I was like, well, how do I make this work for Los Angeles? Because a lot of people try to apply this stuff themselves. Everybody who's successful kind of figures it out on their own. And when I worked in casting and everything else, I'd watch improvisers. I could tell you when I was casting commercials, every school everybody trained at.
You could say Groundlings, you could say UCB. Yep.
And then I had the access to look on the computer and look at their resumes. And I go, oh yeah, nailed it. It was like a fun little game for myself. And you know, the people who really kind of exceeded are the people who could see full big picture and their place in it and whatever else. And it wasn't just thinking of something clever or coming up with a crazy character. It was like a grounded, real kind of a thing. So it's kind of like, well, these schools seem to work and these, I mean, Groundlings people work all the time, but everyone's got to kind of figure it out their own way. And it's like, well, how do we help people figure it out outside of the school and kind of help people out that way? Because there were a lot of people who couldn't apply it. There were amazing improvisers who just never could apply their talents to scripted work, you know, and they kind of struggled. So I think knowing your own voice and knowing who you are and having that really strong POV is the most important thing. And then you can access all that stuff because a lot of people aren't, you know, they're trying to do it the right way rather than their way. So it's just kind of figuring out how to do it your way and apply it.
Is one secret to finding your voice like realizing what type you are or what you're projecting out to the audience?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to that on type. Like, there's a whole thing where I kind of shifted my paradigm of auditioning. When I came, I did okay, like, through my 20s. Like, I got to do recurring on Scrubs. I got a few bits on Mad TV, just, you know, little guest bits. And I started doing commercials. And, you know, by the time I was 24, I had quotes for two TV shows. I'd forgotten all this when I was going through all my stuff this summer.
So people who know what quotes are, it's like, okay, this is the price. If you're going to get this guy.
Yeah, this is how much he's worth. And then right. That kind of set your worth in Hollywood. It's like, oh, his quotes are set at this.
Right. You know? It's an honor, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. But at the time, I wasn't booking shows, so it didn't seem huge to me. And my peers weren't, you know, the guys who were on the teams with me. And, you know, we kind of do this like we're all doing this together. But you realize that quickly it is your career is your very personal thing. Like, improv's its own thing, but your career is your own thing, and you got to kind of cultivate it as a business. And I wasn't super great at that. But the fact that I was doing okay did start to become frustrating, and that's when I left and I had to go to the cruise ships.
And you, when you do the cruise ships, Second City hires you, okay, which is pretty amazing because you're in L.A. and Beth Kligerman calls you all the way out in L.A., right?
Yeah.
And says, will you do the cruise ships?
Yeah. It was really fantastic and serendipitous at the time because I didn't really fully even go through the Second City program. I went through a handful and I was teaching auditioning classes at Second City in LA. But Beth, when I was in college, here's another ballsy thing that I did. I wrote to her and asked to be the Second City intern. And there wasn't an intern program, but they go, okay, you got it. And another girl happened to do the same thing, Amy Rose, who was coming in from the East Coast, who ended up writing for Ellen. She was great. But so I had this most amazing summer that you could ever have. It was right in between Pinata and Citizen Gates.
Mick was directing. You had like Rachel Dratch in that case.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Dratch, Tina was still
Tina
there.
Tina Fey.
Dorf, Allman. I mean, it was fantastic. And I got to sit in some of the rehearsals. They let me sit and watch. But mostly the best part was getting to hang out with all the tour companies. So everybody that now became good friends in L.A., like Kakowski and Tellerico and all these guys, and Brandon Johnson, who I got to put in my pilot 2 years ago, all this stuff, and Dwyer, and Shuley Cowan, who worked with me for 20 years on opening night. That summer was just fantastic. And my job was to archive everything that hadn't been filed in 30 years up to that point, or 25 years.
All the scenes.
Yeah, all the scenes, and they were mimeographed. You know, like, it wasn't even photocopied. They were, like, from a mimeograph machine. And there were photos of people who were maybe in one show or in one touring company. And I didn't know who they were. I had to, like, file and say names. So I was taking them into Joe Sloan.
Yeah.
And I cherished that I got to have those moments. And there were times where we would watch, like, reel-to-reels of, like, the old shows, the smoke-filled room with Arkin and all those guys. So it was a huge schooling on everything. And so that's when I got to learn just by reading sketch and everything. So I feel like I am so entrenched in Second City's history and everything else without being – I was never in a touring company. I was never on the stage. But I got to do the ships, and that was huge for me.
So you work with, when you go to do the ships, Thomas Middleditch, who was on HBO's Silicon Valley. And when you come back, there's a transformation in how you play.
Yeah, absolutely. I think getting to go out and play back with normal people, not the cast, but getting to play to audiences that are Americans that are just out wanting to be entertained.
Mainstream audience.
It's not Los Angeles, arms crossed, show me what you got audiences.
Right.
I was like, well, these are the people who really watch television, and these are the people who are consuming art on a mass scale. So I'm going to change the way that I play in auditions and on stage a little bit too. So I came back with this whole thing where I'm like, I'm just going to be brazen because I'm in LA for one reason alone. If I had a choice, I'd be here in Chicago, especially being here this summer for the last 2 months. Like, I love it here. I love the city, and I wish I was raising my child in the city. But I'm in L.A. for one reason. So I came back with a focus, and then my auditions changed. I'd go off script, everything. And within the first 6 months, I booked my first two series regulars. And I attribute a lot of that to that experience on the ship and getting to kind of be free again. But also, too, I met my wife, and she kind of, like, it was nice. She instilled a new confidence in me.
How much finding your wife helped you?
Well, I think I had a tough time with girlfriends in L.A., and I lived with a couple girls who were actresses, and so much of our relationship was merit-based in terms of how we were doing in our careers, and it was just really kind of soul-crushing. So it's like, well, you're not really doing as well as me, kind of a thing, and that was kind of admitted to me after breakups. I was like, oh, man, so not only is my career crushing me, but it's ruining my relationships and everything else. So it was nice to have somebody who was outside of that. My wife was kind of untouched by that. So it was really kind of lovely to have her come and experience LA in a new way. And then I was back doing it just for us. And it wasn't for, you know, I think there's also a lot of things people do to kind of get over the crushing defeat of auditions. And, you know, they kind of fill their time with other stuff and distractions. And I did, you know, and I had a social life and all these other things that I was doing. And it kind of took my eyes off of the prize. And then when I came back, I'm like, I'm here for one reason. I'm here to work as an actor.
And, you know, growing up here in the Chicago area, going to Indiana, the logical step would be to come and study in Chicago for 5 or 6 mm-hmm. years and then go to L.A. How'd you decide to, you know, I'm just going to go to L.A. and bypass Chicago?
Yeah, I was really champing at the bit, and IO had just opened, so that was really exciting. And my best friend Norm had moved out because he had a job in L.A. And he's like, well, I'm taking classes already. And you won't believe this, but all those guys that you looked up to in Chicago are all here now. So, like, everyone had moved out and were there. I'm like, wow. So when I got to L.A., I felt like it was a kind of a good move because here I am with all these guys who had already matriculated through the program and they'd been on the stages and we're all doing the same stuff now. So I feel like I kind of skipped a grade in a way. And I became good friends with Ed Herbstman in the touring companies when I was interning, and we stayed friends and then became even better friends in L.A. And then I got to understudy Bitter Noah. Right out the gate when I was like 22, 23. Those guys were all 3 or 4 years older than me. And they did this amazing run at the Court Theater where I got pulled in full into the cast. And we had Steve Martin there and, you know, Keanu Reeves. Like, so it was amazing. I'm going to play with these guys who I looked up to as a kid. And now I'm in the fold and Steve Martin's coming backstage and telling me I'm funny. And it was just fantastic.
What was that like playing with them? Because they were a very tight-knit group.
Oh my gosh.
They had all studied at Northwestern here. Then they had gone to I.O. They had done the movie, which was their kind of signature thing mm-hmm. that had gotten to the Aspen Comedy Festival. And in a way, you're in L.A., you're in your 20s, you're kind of the new kid.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and they had cultivated the movie. So for me to jump, it was like jumping onto not even a fast-moving train. It was like jumping onto a spaceship. And those guys were the smartest pants guys around.
Right.
You know, Adrian Wenner and Jason Weiner and Dan and Valancourt. I mean, they're just geniuses. And I know there were times, there were things I still look back at where I missed stuff and I still kick myself, you know, 20 years later. Not that it was like a terrible improv move, but just like, oh, God, I just thought about that a second longer.
It's funny, as you talk about that, you're blushing. Like, you're reliving that shame.
Yeah.
Are you, because I'm somebody who, like, even now, like, I did a show over the weekend and I made some just choices that I'm embarrassed about. How do you get over that today when you're like, oh, I could have done this, I could have done that?
Well, I haven't had that problem in a really long time. And I think I was just kind of, fully just jumping out of the airplane, especially with them. And so I was like, oh, man, I didn't pull my parachute on that. But I think now I know how to pull the chute, you know, and I have at least for the last 15 years. So I don't really have any regrettable moments. There's nights as a group where like, oh, that tonally was a little dark, or we kind of went that way. Well, we'll fix it next time. We haven't really dwelled on anything in a really long time. So that's nice. I've been free of improv hindsight or, you know, whatever.
What about when you audition? How do you let go of the audition? Because I know for me, you go and you audition, you put a lot of pressure on yourself. doesn't go the way you want, and then you, in the car ride home, you are just beating yourself up. Yeah. I could have done this, 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 and I'm a failure.
So, I mean, I had the, like I said, I had the benefit of working in casting for like a decade early on, even when I was, I think, like 24, 25. Liz Paulson, who's now like one of the VPs of casting at Fox, she had just started out as a casting director. She saw me in opening night and she knew that I taught. And she's like, "You're so funny. Would you run my comedy casting sessions for me for commercials? Because I need someone who can do improv off camera and, you know, interact with my actors." And that was kind of my bread and butter for a long time, if they needed somebody to improvise off camera. So I'd go in and do all these things. So I got to see thousands of auditions. And I can tell you that it's like, at the end of the day, you're getting cast for you. You know, like, it's not like the high school production where it's like, okay, you're going to be the grandma. You're going to, like, there's no swath of roles that you get to play. You know, you're going to figure out what you can do. And, you know, it fits within these parameters. And that's about all you're going to be able to do. And you get really good at cultivating that. And this is how I said, I changed my paradigm. When I got into auditions, I was like, I did the best Derek could do. And if I didn't do the best I could do, I could beat myself up about that. It's not like, oh, well, I went up on this line, or I didn't do... It wasn't about doing anything correctly, because there is no right way to do it, I don't think. I think you could just do it your way. And there's hundreds of stories that, like, Brad... what's his face from... Everybody Loves Raymond. That was supposed to be like a small nebbishy character, and Brad Garrett goes in, you've got that big, deep voice, and he's huge, and he won him over just by being himself. So you hear all these times where the script gets flipped, but it's just by being people who are bold and by being themselves.
How do you let go? Because how I approach it is, I go in, I read the script, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do what I think they want me to do.
Yeah, you can't do that.
So how do you let go of that?
You can't. Because here's the other thing, too. If you talk to writers, they're not super in love with the characters. You think that it's like sacrosanct when you read a book, right? When you read a novel and we have like this absolute reverence for the written word. But these guys pitched the show. They probably developed it. The characters changed 4 times by the time it got there. So you have to know it's all part of the process, and you're just another part of the ingredient. So nothing's locked in when it gets there. And it'll probably change after the pilot's done, too. That's the other fun thing, having to come around the other side. It's like, oh, man, that didn't work at all. So we're going to change your character. We love it when you're being more jealous or whatever. So let's pepper more of that in. So you know that you are just there. Your audition is part of the process for that script. You are just one more, handful of sage into that soup or whatever it is. And you just got to do that. Because when I auditioned for Wedding Band, that was really daunting to me because I'd come off a show, got canceled after first season. And then, by the way, this is the other thing. Like, you can't prepare anybody for it. It is awful when your show gets canceled. And other actors will look at you. I think T.J. Miller talked about this too, like, no sympathy for, I heard on your podcast,
right,
for actors. Like, dude, well, you did the thing. Like, suck it up. And so many people told me just to suck it up. But, man, you get depressed because you fall in love with something. You work with people you love. You do it for a year. And then it's just taken away from you, you know? And it's hard. And you hear all the time people say, like, well, I thought I was never going to work again. And you seriously think that. So here I was when I was coming in to do Wedding Band for TBS. And it's Brian Austin Green, Harold Pirineau. They both have already been cast. And I'm sitting in the waiting room, and there's 3 other guys. There's a musical theater guy, and there's 2 other guys who know how to play the drums. I'm supposed to be a drummer, and I've never played the drums in my life. And I looked around, and I go, well, that guy's been on that, and this guy's done this, and that's what they do. But they don't improvise. I improvise. That's my thing. So I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to do everything I can do in this audition. And I went in, and I don't know that I said one word correctly that was in the script. Just completely improvised.
How do you get the confidence to go, okay, I see this script. I'm eyeballing what's going on. I'm seeing this guy does this. This guy does. I'm an improviser. I'm going to trust myself so much that I'm going to let go of the script and I'm going to go in there.
Yeah.
And just improvise.
Well, it's because that's what they want from you. You know, you have to know that's why they brought you in. You know, whatever they saw in the first call, that's what they want to see more of. So I'm going to now take that to 11 or whatever it is. I'm just going to do more of what I gave them in the beginning. I'm not going to draw it back. I'm just going to do more of that. And in that audition, in that test, it's so funny, the showrunners found that test on tape and they sent it to me. So it was neat to watch an audition again. So I have the tape of the network test.
What did you see when you watched it again?
Just how much fun I was having. I just completely let go. Like, I didn't have even my script in my hand, I don't think. It was all 4 of us that ended up being in the band together. Sat around a table talking, and I went nuts. I threw a chair in the audition, and I remember riding in the elevator. I had to fly out the next day to go do a hosting gig, so I was rushing to get to the airport, and I rushed to get in the elevator, and Brian Austin Green got in with me, and we're sitting there quiet, and he looks at me and goes, man, you're fucking crazy. You threw a chair in there. I go, oh, I'm so sorry. He's like, no, that was awesome, man. That was awesome. So, and then it kind of showed me. It's like, yeah, that's what you have to do. You have to throw some chairs or whatever it is, you know.
The other thing you talk about is having fun. You know, yeah. if it's you're doing musical improv, if you're just doing a Herald, if you're going on an audition, what do you do when you're like, oh, my God, you don't feel the fun? How do you make that adjustment?
That's tough. I mean, because if you're in a dead room and people aren't picking up on it, I mean, it's like, you know, I've heard people come on your podcast and they talk about, well, this is my time. It's just another chance to perform and to really love auditions in that way and to kind of have that relationship with them where you're not beating yourself up. And I coach actors up through pilot season, through everything. And I really try to stress on them, like, let's find where this is exciting for you and cool for you to do this performance. And let's, yeah. So when you walk in, you're like, fuck, I'm just performing. I'm just doing my thing. So I think if you kind of prep yourself, that's the best way to do it. But when you get in a room and it's just totally dead, I went on one right before I left. And they're like, well, we don't want you to do this one thing in the thing. I'm like, oh, man, but I totally practiced it that way. It's like, do it without the accent or whatever it is, you know, or do it. This was a guy who had an arm that was being controlled by a robotic thing that he couldn't control. And I'm like, well, that's the funny bit of it. And they're like, well, don't worry about that. I'm like, oh, man. So I did the scene and I was walking out. I'm like, I'm going to do that another time for you guys. I stopped myself at the door and I said, I really want to do the arm bit. And they're like, okay. So, you know, sometimes you can ask and like do it. And then I did it with the arm bit because I had prepared it. And they were all dying laughing. And they go, thank you. They go, that was much funnier with the arm bit. And I'm like, so sometimes you just got to kind of trust your instincts. And, you know, obviously you don't want to piss them off if they're running over schedule and like you're trying to be sensitive to that whole thing. But it's like, that's my time. I drove an hour to get there. I'm going to take 2 extra minutes and do my arm bit that I prepared. So, and I think that they respect you for that because they know if you did the work, hopefully, you know, so.
And now, so you've been in LA for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Opening night was musical improv group that you were a part of.
Yeah.
Take us back to when you first got there. When you're in your 20s, the scene of Los Angeles, the improv scene, and how much it's changed.
I mean, it's night and day from what it was. It's unrecognizable. And I'm sure everybody's come in and they talked about how there was just these little pockets of stuff going on. And it was really exciting to be starting the theater with I.O. Because everybody was so into it. It didn't really exist. People would come see it and they were blown away. Like early in those early days, I mean, opening night has been my mainstay throughout Los Angeles. Those are my best friends. The best shows I've ever done is with that group. And I'm so happy that we started that within 5 months of me landing in Los Angeles. Because Norm and I were doing little, we hosted the shows. We were the social chairman. That was part of our internship. I was there 6 nights a week.
I owe it the little space on Santa Monica. It was a little black box.
Yeah. When we were invested. I was in like 3 groups. I was doing Bitter Noah, was doing opening night, and then I was on maybe 2 other house teams. I mean, it's just always there. And then also classes and everything else. So we were really excited. And when, you know, there was a time, too, going back to this, talking about casting, in those early days when I was running sessions, we go, okay, we're going to have you guys have some fun with this. And that was the key code word for improvise. You couldn't say improvise because you had to pay extra for that. So you always say, so you can come in and you guys can make the script your own. You can have some fun with it. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And people knew that was improvise. And you would watch some actors leave the room. They're like, well, I'm not trained in improv. Thank you. And they'd leave. There was big comedians. I could name names. Guys now that wouldn't have a problem with it. But back in the day, they're like, yeah, I don't improvise. And they'd leave. Which that just shows you where improv was, you know, 20 years ago.
You're talking about
ago.
Well-established stand-ups
mm-hmm.
who probably did crowd work, right?
Yeah.
With, you Absolutely. Know, hecklers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And when they were thrown in there, they were like, can't do it.
Yeah,
and
I'm just going to do the script. Yeah. So it was kind of funny to watch that evolution happen just within the industry and then watch how quickly, you know, people assimilate and like, oh, well, this guy can go off script or they can do the stuff or they can add tags and to kind of watch how people started to get trained and watched how that kind of started to steamroll. But yeah, and it was crazy in those in that first 10 years of I.O., but when we moved over to the other theater and then, you know, UCB was just in the back of I.O. when it started. You know, Besser was kind of running everything out of the back, which was interesting. And then everybody started coming from New York and we got to have Jamie Denbo come play with opening night and the influx of the New York stuff. And then when they opened, I mean, it was neat to watch it kind of unfold. And now the downside of it is I think it grew so quickly we lost some of the oral tradition. There people don't know from whence things came or why they're learning the things they're learning.
Why is that important? Why is history, be it Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, why is history important to someone who's studying improv today?
Because here it is. Because improv is you, right? And I'm going to keep talking about yourself and your POV. And if you don't understand the process of why you're doing the thing that you're doing, you're not seeing yourself in that process, right? So if you're learning the invocation and it's just taken completely out of context and you don't know why you're learning it or the mysticism around it or whatever else, the things that are supposed to get you excited in your soul about that thing or any exercise, you're losing a huge chunk of it. You're just kind of, you know, it's like learning how to do, I always say it's like learning how to do backwards math. It's like, here's this, and this is how you get there. And it's like, well, I need to learn the full equation so I can get the right answer. Instead of just knowing the answer. Here's the answer, just reproduce this answer. So that's why I think knowing, even if it's not logistically what the exercise is, knowing the, you know, the culture that created that exercise or that form or whatever it was, because this was a reaction against something or it was born of the performers who created it. And if you have those touchstones, I think you can bring yourself to that work a little bit more.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this. I have to tell you something. After 25 years, I enjoy teaching improv more than I do performing it. And what I love about teaching the art of slow comedy is that it's a more honest approach to scenic improv. And when it works, nothing is better. It makes improv as easy as having a conversation. People relax and they take the pressure off themselves, not only to have more fun, but to let their authentic selves come through. They feel more connected to the people in their class on a deeper level. They trust more and they take more risks. Their work is amazing to watch. Doesn't matter if you're a seasoned improviser and you've been through every program that's out there, or you're new to improv, or you're an actor who's afraid to try improv. They've always wanted to do it, but they don't think they can. I want to work with you. I love teaching this style of improv. I want to help you. And I have two opportunities this fall. If you don't have much time, and I'm offering a one-day Intro to Art of Slow Comedy on October 13th here in Chicago. And if you're in the Chicagoland area and you have more time to commit, I have a six-week Art of Slow Comedy Level 1 class starting October 31st here in Chicago. For more information or to register because you're so excited about what I just said, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. When you were doing opening night, this is 20 years ago, right? And you're doing musical improv. And I would, and I think about musical improv, me being in Chicago, Baby Wants Candy,
mm-hmm.
Okay, starts it. And there's almost like, now there's almost like a division. Some people do musical improv, some people do regular
right.
improv. What gravitated you to musical improv?
Well, I was a failed musical theater major, so it was like the next logical progression for me to kind of do it. And we had started doing musical improv stuff at IU, so we weren't completely in the dark with it. We did improvised musical, like brief little 15-minute things at the end of our show.
Throw out a style and you would do that?
Well, we got a title. We would actually, yeah, it wasn't just the line games. I mean, we would do, in the beginning, those kind of hackneyed, like, you know, hoedown or whatever. Not that they're hackneyed, but they, you know, they are what they are. And I love them, and I'll spit out a good rhyme for them. But we were trying to do little mini musicals out the gate because we were all big musical fans. And I think it was more fun to ape the tropes than to do the bits or whatever. So... but yeah, we started a little bit, we started around the same time as Baby. I don't know who was first. I'd like to say that we were first, but I don't know that exactly we were. But we were completely, you know, separate from everything else. So we had to develop that form all by ourselves and kind of figure out how all musicals work. And up until even before I left, we rehearsed every week for an hour and a half before the show, implementing new things for musicals. And I think that's the reason why that show lasted so long.
Why is that important for the players?
Because musicals are evolving, everything, art's evolving. So, you know, it's like, okay, cool, so none of us are very good at rapping, so let's try to work some elements of Hamilton or whatever. However, the musical landscape's changing. If we're making fun of that thing, we need to kind of be ahead of the curve. And especially all of us are in our 40s now, for us to, like, you know, teaching old dogs new tricks, people just want to show up and do the show and that's it. But you're kind of doing yourself a huge disservice. And we were a show that kind of prided ourselves on, you know, we still dressed up for the show every week. You know, Baby does the same thing, too. And I think it had a different polish or, you know, to it. And people, that show sold out almost, you know, all the way till when I left LA.
And when you came here into Chicago, you got to play with Baby.
Yeah.
So how did what you learned in LA translate to playing with Baby
well,
in
I
Chicago?
Well, I think, you know, separate from each other, I think we all came to the same conclusions as to how that musical form should work. So when I sat in with that show on Saturday, I had an absolute blast with all these people I've never met before. But I think there was just, we all knew we're making fun of this musical. This one was making, it was like pretty much the same plot as The Lion King. It was called The On Lion King. So we had a nice, easy, we knew where we were going to end up at the end. But it was it felt like doing an opening night show. Because I think everybody, you know, even though we weren't learning it together, I think everybody probably stumbled and fell and made all the same mistakes. And
are you
ended
a little nervous
solution.
Going into that? You know, like, oh my God, I haven't worked with these people. This isn't opening night. This isn't the cast that I know. It's musical improv. Sure, we all speak the same language, but again, I'm the new kid.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I apologize if I thought I was shoehorning. I ended up being the protagonist in the thing. And here I was, I'm like, I'm going to sit back and watch these guys. We'll do it. And the next thing, you know, but that's not how the show works. It's like, oh, you're in the first scene. Now you're the protagonist and you got to go for it. And it was a sold out show and it was with guys I didn't know. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but they were so nice. They were so great. And I think, especially with that form, that, you know, there isn't, like normal improv, it's a narrative, right? So you know where the ride is going and you kind of get to jump on board. So there was some relief in that. And that could freak people out too. Like, I don't want to F up the plot or do whatever. But no, once we got going, I was not nervous at all or when to edit. And I was just, they were a great crew. So I think there is something to that. Like, when you know that the form is, you know, the play's the thing. And that's what's going to be more important. So it made it easy.
You know, you talk a lot about finding your voice and point of view. What is your point of view as an improviser, you think, if you had to break it down?
Well, the way that I kind of, like, I changed teaching is just because people didn't have that history or whatever else. So I stripped it all back, and I'm like, well, let's just find how you emotionally connect with suggestion. And in my whole relationship with suggestion has changed because it's kind of God. It's the only thing that presents to the audience that we are doing something that's never been done before, right? Just because this suggestion just came from the audience. So what's your relationship to that? How does that thing, instead of doing an A to C thought or whatever else, my thing now is like A to E. How does it make you feel? A to emotion. Like, what's the word spark inside of you?
Great. So let me give you a couple of examples and
sure.
So people listening can understand your process. Love is the theme, or love is the suggestion.
Okay. I'm away from my wife right now, so yearning would be my first thing. So there's something missing, right? That's just the ultimate feeling that I have. So if somebody comes out, and no matter what they initiate in the physical world, if they're smelling a flower, whatever else, I could look at them and go, oh, I wish I could smell flowers like you could. Look at the way you smell that flower. I don't have a flower of my own to smell. And now I've got everything. To me, off that first feeling. And I can carry that through, at least through that scene, have a little arc of where that's going to go.
Coffee?
Okay. I'm drinking coffee now. I know when I get to my third cup, I just know now I can already feel that the acid reflux is coming. So there I am. It's hard for me to talk. It's uncomfortable. So whatever we're doing now is going to feel acid refluxy to me. The way you're nodding your head is just a little bit too much
Phil,
for me.
Phil, just all you have to do is just put 50 cents in and get me a Coke.
Oh, God, 50 cents.
Yeah, here.
Oh, look at, do you see this coin? It's filthy. I'm going to have germs from this all day. Here you go. You know what I mean? So then now I'm navigating life that everything's kind of this through this acid reflux vein.
Angels?
Euphoria, heaven, right? Feel nice. You see this like postcard of it. So now everything is kind of walking on air. That's the emotion I'm having of it.
All right, we got to get back into the game, okay?
Oh, we get to play more?
Yeah, we do. So
I can't
we need
wait.
You to focus.
I'm focused. I'm here.
Great.
Oh, can you see the focus in my eyes?
I totally can see the focus.
Yes.
We're down by 14.
Just 14.
Yeah.
Well, that's it.
Yeah,
we
that's
can do
it.
This.
That's it. So we're going to run over. I'm just going to go to the chalkboard here.
Yeah, show me the plays. Okay, so I'm going to hit them so hard when I get out there. I'm going to crush their skulls. Yes.
So, and one more. Let's do chocolate.
Like decadence is my first feeling. Like, oh, I'm having something special. So this is a special treat. Right now what we're doing, this is very special. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You want more ham salad?
Oh, can I?
Yeah, go ahead. It's for your party.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is going to be the night.
Yeah.
We're living, James. We are living.
Yes, we are. And help yourself to any of these crackers. I bought them all for you.
Do you have a town? This is a townhouse buttery cracker.
Yes. Yeah.
Ooh.
And whatever is left, you can take home with you.
Stop it.
Yeah. It's your birthday. Nathan, happy birthday.
I just have to tell you, this is the best birthday I've ever had. I feel special.
Yeah.
And it's not even like on a decade. It's like, this is 28.
Yeah, I know. I know.
It's not even 30. Yeah. I can't wait till 2 years from now.
Carol's coming.
Carol?
Mm-hmm.
How did she find the time for me?
She loves you. She loves
Stop
you.
It.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Yeah, so.
So it's very interesting. How do you make that? Because that's something I struggle with, is coming up with a point of view. You're starting with an emotion. You're starting with a point of view.
Yeah, and I think we all have a guttural feeling to something, and that's the thing I love about Susan's teaching so much messing, is like you have this gasp, aha kind of a moment, and it's just kind of like nurturing that baby inside of yourself that hears a word and goes, because we frame things so fast. You know, if you read books like Blink, you know, we thin slice something really fast. So just becoming really kind of in tune with that. And I try to bring that over too in teaching with scripts and stuff, because you read a script and you have a feeling right away when you read a character. But you go, oh, this guy's this. Mm-hmm. And it's like, hang on to that, because that's your entry point for that character. Because you might read the whole scene and go like, well, actually, it's more this. It's like, no, something struck you that way. Mm-hmm. And I don't want you to pull away from that.
Now, that would be in conflict a little with Del Close's theory, which Del was always like, the third choice. Make the third choice. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're almost saying, okay, go with your first emotional reaction to something.
Yeah, because I think all that, I think those other, I think that stuff in the beginning of that teaching was to get you to pull away from just saying like, hey, salt shaker's your suggestion, and someone comes out shaking salt.
Right.
Right? So it's like, let's find your third thing. Right? Let's find your third thing will hopefully drive you deeper inside. But I think there is something deeper inside when you say salt shaker and you think like, oh my God, my heart problem. The doctor told me not to have any salt. So there's this like trepidation about it. So that already is almost like a third thing away from it. You went boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. But it's just doing it emotionally rather than literally.
I'm almost wondering too, if you go to the emotion, you are, like you said, you go right to the third thing automatically. Mm-hmm. You're going around it.
Yeah. Because I'm not talking about the salt shaker. I'm just operating through the world with the trepidation that I have for salt or whatever it is. And that's enough. And characters are all metaphors for something else, right? They're all there on the page to give us a, you know, I don't know. Chris Barnes, this was really cool. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, he was teaching out of Santa Monica doing
the improv dojo.
The dojo. So yeah. I got to study at the dojo with him. And we were doing all the enneagrams, the personality types.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure you heard all this.
Yes, yes. So just explain to people who don't know what enneagrams are.
Yeah, so it's the 9 personality types. You can kind of slot yourself in there. It's kind of how you see the world, and you might be several different things. People do the, what's the thing they do nowadays on the dating sites? There's like the EMFJ, whatever that one is. You know, that's kind of the more modern version of it. But through these 9, we were able to kind of break them down to archetypes, and it's kind of how they see the world, and that was the easier way to navigate it. It's like we know the mediator sees everyone as having a problem. That's Michael Bluth on Arrested Development, or everybody looks at things analytically, and that's, you know, Frasier or Nye. Miles, rather. So it was kind of neat to kind of like make these things really archetypical and break them down for sitcom characters, because sitcom characters really at the most have 2 dimensions. You know, it's like they have 1 standing operating procedure and then they got 1 more backup like that. So when we kind of broke things down, not that I'm super mathematical about it, but to me, I think it gives you a great ease when you're in improv. It's like, oh, I just have to do 1 thing. Frasier only does 1 thing. Michael Bluth only does 1 thing. I don't have to do all the things on stage, have all the emotions. You know.
Well, I found too is when if you can find the one thing, whatever it is, it makes improv so much easier. But it's finding that one thing that can be. It seems like, you know, it takes miles to get there.
Sure, but I think it's there right away. And that's what I was trying to say, like, how can I make improv emulate more scripted work? And this is for Los Angeles. It doesn't work for everywhere. I love slow play, too. I love watching people discover something together and things evolve out of room. But if we're going to make things in Los Angeles emulate scripted work, sitcoms, people come out of the gate firing on all cylinders. And I think that we have the potential to do that, but it is, again, like it's our relationship with suggestion or we kind of accessing that stuff a little bit quicker. And it's there, though, and it's much more simple than people think, and we have it, and we have those reactions to suggestion. And so I think we can kind of – and then that's going to help our scripted work, too. And when you start to operate that way, then you can jump into a script and go, oh, I just see the world this way.
How did you find this method for yourself?
Well, kind of like also through running sessions and everything, you know, a 30-second commercial is like you have to end up here. There's going to be a small arc. And this is where the joke is at the end of the scene or at the end of the commercial. Where do you have to be at the beginning of that? It's got to be – you have to be sitting in an emotional state for that to have that transition within those 30 seconds. So if you don't come out the gate with something, if you're just kind of existing – 30 seconds goes really quick. And now you're manufacturing this ending. So it's like, okay, how can I get to that a little bit faster? So obviously it's going to pay off for my big improvisational thing at the end or whatever my discovery is going to be. So I kind of cultivated that over time. It's like, okay, now how can we do that? And then also too, in sitcoms are showing up for a scene. And even when I was, you know, when I was doing shows and getting to do a full series of something, it's like, oh, well, this is kind of a throwaway scene. This is a scene in between these two scenes. I'm like, I want to have something in every scene that's kind of emotional and have a little bit of business or to kind of have that stuff. So it's not just like I'm just sitting here at the table while the other characters are talking. I'm like, what's my thing in this scene? I'm going to be chewing on an eraser or just there's something there always.
And would you make some sort of emotional choice? Like, okay, it's a scene. You've got one line and you're like, I'm going to chew on the eraser. But I know I'm going to be agitated.
Yeah, I'm chewing on the eraser for a reason. I'm not just like doing a bit. Like right. I kind of put that the wrong way. But I'm just like, yeah, well, how am I feeling this moment? Am I really excited? Or my guy was like kind of generally naively excited about stuff. So which was nice because you have that thing. It's like, this is all my character does. He's naively excited or he stands his ground on stuff that seems too corporate or whatever. And so it's like, great, I'm going to be doing something in between there.
What would you tell improvisers who want to be actors, meaning who want to be cast in movies, who want to be cast in films, who want to be cast, movies and films are the same thing, who want to be in TV and commercials, what would you tell them?
Well, nowadays, you know, everybody says, go make your own stuff. Definitely do that. And I say also approach your improv like you are auditioning for a show, like you're putting on something that you want people to watch and to see and to respect. So when you approach it, do rehearse, do have a thing, have a point of view. It's not, I always call fun, fuck around time. When I watch a team that's just having fun, fuck around team, I'm like, you're not here. And I know from your group who's not going to succeed. I've been around long enough.
How can you tell by watching a group who's going to succeed and who's not? Tell us what's going in your head when you watch a group and you go, that person's not going to make it. That person's not going to make it.
Well, I think that there's a reverence and respect for the art. They're coming out there. They want to achieve something. It might even be that they want people to, selfishly watch them, you know, but it at least has something there. Do you know what I mean? The it factor, you can't explain. There are people who just have it and they're super charming and you're like, oh my gosh, that person's going to do it. And I don't know, it's cultivated. I don't know that I ever had that it factor. I'd like, you know, there was something that made them pick me to do Better Know at 22, but I think most of what I've gotten has been through hard work and me wanting to put myself in that position. And then, like I said, every time I'm on stage, I want to mean it. Every time I'm in a throwaway scene in a TV show, I want that to be okay to put on my reel. I want to be doing something that's active and engaging and whatever. So I don't think I've ever kind of dropped my guard in that way. So
when you watch an improv group and you go, okay, here are three things I think you guys should do to either get your team to the next level or your group to the next level, what would those be?
Well, in LA, it's like, I think first off, there's marketing. What is your show? How is it different?
But I just want to play. I just want to play. I don't want to be the producer. I don't want to market.
Then good luck. Okay. You know what I mean? It's like, and there are those shows. There's shows that I'll go to a clubhouse and we'll do a fun fuck around show, or we'll do a show where it's like it's okay to have a few beers beforehand, and that's fun too, and that's a decent workout. But for opening night, every one of those shows, I wanted to, like, if you know Guffman's here tonight or whatever it is, you gotta kind of have that thing.
So marketing and everybody take a responsibility in producing the show.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, look at the shows that have been most successful, like the Improvised Shakespeare Company and things that are touring the world and doing all that stuff. They're machines, and they have guys behind it who really believe. They got a great
website, and you know, Blaine rehearses. Those guys, Blaine Swen, they rehearse, and they, you know, he markets the show, and he's got a brand.
Yeah.
So producing is one. What else would you say?
The next I think is like, you know, the play is the thing. Like I said, you know, with opening night or with the movie or these things, like, you know that the piece, once you have your piece locked in or your form or whatever it is, there's no, you know, people say like you can't note each other. When you have a really great form, you shouldn't have to. It's because, like, you guys all know, like, what needs to occur within this piece, and we can kind of see that. And
what did you say? You don't know each other?
Note each other. We don't give notes to each other. It's like, okay. I mean, have a director. Absolutely have a director and other eyes on it. But we were able to kind of, with opening night, direct from within. We had Shuley was our director throughout the years.
Cowan.
Yep. And I'm sure there were times where like, well, I don't know that I was doing that. You were in the scene with me, so it was kind of hard for you. But overall, I think we had such reverence for what the show should be that it was fine to get notes from somebody else in the cast. You know, and was able to kind of navigate that. And she was always striving to find new things for us. And, you know, so I think that's the other thing, too. Like, be innovating and be bringing new stuff to rehearsal. Don't let it get stagnant.
What about presentation? What about how we dress on stage and lights and music and all that?
You know, to me, I think it's like, I always tell my students, dress better than the audience. You know, there's times when, you know, guys would show up in a, you know, a tank top and cargo shorts, and it was just kind of frustrating for me. It's like, well, why would I pay to see that? You know, why would I come here and pay money to watch some guy who looks like, it was a guy I yelled at years ago for wearing a hat on stage. I was like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I got to wear the hat. I didn't shower. I'm like, you didn't shower before your show? Like, you have no respect for this. You know, to me, that just blew my mind. But that's the attitude a lot of people nowadays, because it is so, there's so much DIY kind of punk rock improv, especially in Los Angeles, where it's small, it's done everywhere, it's done on a bus, it's done, you know, and people just kind of have this point of view. Like, there were some students of mine who came to see opening night, and I'm like, oh, what'd you think? That was great. It's like, well, it's really polished, though. And, like, they had a disdain for it. And it's like, okay, well, that's fine. But, you know, it's like, what do you want to do? Why are you here in Los Angeles? And that's fine. If you're just here to do punk rock improv, that's cool. But if you want to do something else, the reason why I was in Los Angeles was to work. And I was out there because I wanted to be a working actor. If I wanted to just do improv, I don't think I would have been there. Because it's not the best audiences. It's not the most rewarding improv. You know, opening night was, for sure. But I think the scene is very different. If I wanted to just do improv, I would have stayed in Chicago.
And now you've left L.A. Mm-hmm. And how'd you decide to make that decision?
Well, it's like when I left on the cruise ships, I felt like I couldn't find fifth gear. You know, like I was working, but it just wasn't enough for me to be fulfilled and everything else. And then the second time around for us to decide to leave, it's been 10 years since the shift, and now I've got a wife and a kid, so it's a little bit heftier of a decision to go. But the work's changed. You know, about 8 years ago, I saw everything was going digital, so I started to try to produce content, and I directed digital, and I started to make all these changes, and I started to do voiceover and hosting, because I saw that your palette had to really be full just to eke out a living doing it. And there were times when I was on a show and I was still running sessions, and I had actors, and they're like, dude, aren't you on a show? I saw you on TV last night.
And you're running the camera.
Yeah. And I go, yeah. And they're like, and you're still here doing this? I go, yeah. And they're like, oh, fuck, this business is hard. I go, yeah, because I don't know if we're getting a second season. And I didn't. So I kind of was always ahead of the game, but then it kind of got to a point now where it's like commercials now are mostly non-union. And so all of us union actors who've been around and have done, you know, upwards of 100 commercials have lost a huge chunk of their income. Almost 60, 70% of their income's disappeared. And, you know, I could stick around and try to get on another show. I had a pilot 2 years ago that had Brandon Johnson in and Brian Shortall, Jill Benjamin, and Nicole Parker, who was in Full Frontal and also did Boom. I was able to cast all these friends, Ryan Hansen and Eliza Cooper, the leads. And then that didn't go. And then I did the McNapier sketch show with Blaine Swen and Alex Moffat, Chris Redd. And that was amazing. And then that one didn't go. So it's just like a couple
Why
of handfuls.
Why didn't that one go?
Well, I think that one was tricky because they're trying to do a primetime sketch show that's family friendly. They kept saying like Walmart audience. And here you are.
They would say that?
Yeah. Yeah.
The executives would be like, yeah.
These are the guys who did The Voice and everything
right.
else. And we're locked in the room with geniuses. We had Brian Jack in there and Brad Morris and, you know, these amazing writers and who do awesome stuff and Colton Dunn. And we're all in this trailer like pumping out. I think we were like 4,000 sketches in 3 months. It was crazy. And it was just like, well, you have these guys who have teeth and have a point of view, and you're stripping that away from them. So it just was kind of tough. Like, everybody felt like there was, like, that, you know, speed monitor on them, you know, like on a U-Haul truck. It's like, you can't go over 55. And you have Mick, who's like, if you want to have divisive comedy,
right.
here you have Mick. And it's like, also, you've, like, put this limiter on him as well. So I think we were kind of doomed to fail from the start because it was very polished and, you know, it felt like we were doing all that comedy with these adults, you know, like Nickelodeon style sketch.
How was that for you? Because your interaction with Mick was, here you were in your 20s, mm-hmm. you were, you know, watching him direct Paradigm Lost, and now all of a sudden he's cast you in this,
oh,
in
man.
This pilot.
Oh yeah, and I was so excited. Well, here's the other thing too, is like, for me, I was coming off of a show, and it was a huge pay cut to go do this, and I'm like, well, when will I ever get a chance? I was through the SNL auditions, and, mm-hmm. and I was already too old. I was like 30.
You had auditioned for SNL?
That's how we got this one, yeah. So I had gone through two rounds of auditions when they came out for SNL people, and that's how we all got this NBC show, because the NBC casting people were there with the SNL people. So that's how we all got this show. So when I got in, they said, oh, Mick's going to be the director. I'm like, oh, I'm in for sure, 100%. Because I had never really done a ton of sketch. I'd never written a review, never done anything, but I really wanted that challenge, and it was really fantastic to say, oh, I can turn out 4 sketches a night, you know, at 35, having never done it before or whatever.
And now you're really using your improv skills in life because you're going to England.
Yes.
and I heard that you've always loved England.
Yeah, I lived there briefly after college. I went and I did improv in Camden with a little group, and I was trying to teach them the Herald. They were doing little improvised one-act plays, and that was a blast. And then since then, it's kind of blown up. There was a friend, friends of friends who started a theater there, and apparently drunkenly at a wedding, I gave them the idea of how to start a theater in London, and they're doing really well.
So what's the name of the theater?
The Free Association.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I'm hoping to go over and start teaching and then, redoing all my reels. And then friends have been so fantastic. They're like, oh, please talk to my agents there. You got to talk to mine first. And I never had that kind of love in L.A. So already out the gate, I'm feeling really good about it.
But this really is a bigger move than even at 24 or 20 going to Los Angeles. I mean, it's different because you're married. Mm-hmm. You have a son.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, it's definitely like jump and the net will appear. It's the grandest version of it. But I think I've always known, like, when life got a little stagnant, I had to make a big change. And when I left L.A., it was awesome. Everybody came out of the woodwork and support. But the best comment was a friend of mine, who was another lifer guy, goes, wait a minute, we can leave? You know, like everyone feels like we're on this path and we can't leave our dream and we can't leave the thing that we're doing. And it's like, well, that's not it really, because it's the art and that's the thing. My dream wasn't to keep, you know, rolling the ball up the hill like Sisyphus, hoping for more of the same.
Was your dream?
I think it's the excitement of it. It's that, what's the thing that's going to be the next? Because I know it's like, okay, cool, I'm going to keep doing this stuff. And I figured out how to write a show and I figured out how to try to sell stuff. And, you know, I never really cracked the nut completely and sold something. You know, I got stuff made, I got a pilot made, and I got different things done. But it's just like, I'm not thrilled by it. It's now actually gone into the mechanization of it, of like, you know, of trying to create something just to sell. And I don't want that anymore. I'm going to try to find out whatever exciting thing. And that's what I saw in this English improv scene when I was there. It was like, it was so fresh, it was exciting, and it was from their point of view, and it was untouched by teaching that was like mechanical. You know, it was very much like born of English hesitation or, you know, their quaffed emotions.
Has improv teaching in the States become mechanical?
I think so. I think it's like, you know, there's, you know, whether you're accredited by a university or whatever it is, it's kind of plug and play, or there's a binder that teachers, and it's like, okay, bring a little bit of yourself to it. But it's like, you know, I look back at those classes when I started at IO when I was 17, 18, it was like, okay, today we're gonna, you know, we borrowed all the masks from Strap Heads and we like did that one class. It was just like, it was weird. Like everything was weird and different. And then to now just be like, okay, today you're just gonna do this or that, it seems really weird to me, and it should be more fluid. And I was trying to hopefully bring that into when I was teaching, like, well, what's kind of the whims of the day, or, you know, like, let's kind of explore the human experience a little more.
And as a teacher, how do you, and this is really a question I have for myself, and I'd love to know your answer, is how do you make it be inspired and not make it mechanical and not go, you know what, I'm teaching level one, this is what I teach in level one, and I'm just going to go through the exercises. What do you do?
I think it's like we have to be inspired as teachers, and we have to keep looking at things. And like, you know, if we bring in an article, like, you know, like Dell did, I was like looking at the newspapers, like, all right, this thing's interesting, let's fucking do this thing. And I was like, well, that's great, and that's today, and that's something that he saw and was inspired by. So I'm going to be inspired because it was born of inspiration, not born of a curriculum. So it's like, oh, I heard a thing on NPR, Danny Boyle talking about how there's no elements past 20 minutes in a film that shouldn't be regurgitated. Let's really work on that first thing and then keep recycling those ideas. And then like, well, it's just born out of something I heard on the way to class that day. So I think if we as instructors are kind of seeing that world through that lens, like, well, how can we bring our inspiration to our students? I think we're really going to be benefiting them that way.
And how do you get them to buy into that? Because there is that, you know, level system or mechanical way to do improv. I've got to do a show in 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's great that you read an article about, you know, something, how does that help me do the Herald better? That whole, like, I want to get better faster now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, outside of doing reps and doing all that stuff, obviously there is, like, you know, that's why I was trying to kind of tailor my teaching more to, like, okay, cool, if you know yourself in the beginning, then any form I throw at you, you're going to know how to handle yourself in it first. Like, let's take care of you first, and then we'll figure out the mechanics. So if I know your operating state when you get these suggestions or these emotions, no matter where I plug and play you, you're going to be okay, because you're going to play it like you're a real character existing within this world or within this form or whatever. So, I mean, it's a different way of looking at it. It's definitely from a narrative standpoint, it doesn't work as well. I mean, like, it can for the deconstruction or other things like that are a little more heady. But for the most part, I think if you know yourself really well, you can jump into that stuff and you'll be taken care of.
We got to wrap this up, but yeah. Two questions before we go. One is, why do you think improvisers have now finally done really well in TV and film in Los Angeles? Because when I started out in the 80s, like, improv, like, they didn't know how to translate it at all to the medium.
I mean, I think it's just... it's been a slow matriculation and also an infiltration of of everything, where it's like, oh, these improvisers can do these things. And now we also have writers or directors that know improv. So they'll go and, you know, you'll be on set and a director's like, oh, can you do a run? It's like, oh, cool, I'm going to pick up these glasses and go, hey, check out these glasses, but I'm going to do 8 in a row of that, 8 different things. Like, that's a run. And it's like, oh, cool, so now I have this director that trusts me enough that I'm going to give him 8 fun different things. Or, you know, it's like voiceover, stuff like that. So you have these directors that now know when they get them. It was funny, too, on Wedding Band, there was this instance when we had a director in, and he was trying to give me, like, a line read and how to do something. And he was like, no, like, do this. And Brian Austin Green, this was one of the coolest things that ever happened to me. He stopped and goes, hang on, Derek's an improv genius. You just let him go. And he stopped the director, and then, like, I was like, oh, that was the coolest thing that's happened. So I think that's how the culture has evolved now, where even other actors, like, oh, I know what his talent is, and that's his thing, and they can kind of see that.
Only an established star could have done something
like
that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then that he saw that in you, and...
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have said anything. I couldn't have been like, well, hang on, dude, let me just do it how I'll do it, you know?
No, I would have still been trying to please the director.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We'd still be there. We got to wrap this up. We always ask the same question. What's one piece of advice you'd give to somebody starting out in improv today?
I'd say fun. Have that. If you don't have that inspiration and that zeal, the audience smells it. You won't feel it. And I think that's kind of it all. And that's what I'm trying to recapture by going and doing something else. I want to find that zeal again. And I want to watch people see that excitement in me and have that X factor of the performance in the play. So if it's starting to become down or a drag, stop. Take a break. People need to take breaks for a while. Come back to the work when you're reinvigorated and it's fun. If it's a slog, I always say this too. This was the thing to students. I go, never say I have a show tonight. I get to do a show tonight. Or I have to go to rehearsal. I get to go to rehearsal.
What's the difference?
You change that in your brain and then it becomes a positive. I get to go experience this thing. Or, oh, I have to go this audition. No, I get to go audition tomorrow. And then it's like a thing. Because that's what you've been wanting to do. It's not an obligation. Unless you make it an obligation, you know? I mean, it's an obligation to go to a show and your obligation to your friends. But when you look at it from that perspective, it kind of changes everything. I was going to give you one little other thing, too. We're talking about emotion. I just want to give this to people if they want to check this out. This is a thing that I implemented in my teaching, and it's been really great. If you're talking about emotions, you know, something starting, like, well, where do I go? What happens next? Where's this arc? There's this color wheel of emotions. Have you seen this before? I'll send it to you. It's
Please
fantastic.
Do.
So it's all the germinating beginning emotions of stuff. So interest breeds excitement, breeds euphoria, whatever. So it's this color system of how emotions heighten. And because, you know, a lot of times when we teach emotion, it's like, okay, cool, let's take boredom to a 10. Well, boredom turns to something else when it gets to a 10. You know, it turns to irritability, it turns to self-loathing, whatever it is. But this kind of helps you. So when you learn yourself in these, you know, these the germination of the emotions, so you're operating, and then it finds out where I can go with that. What's the next logical step? It's really fantastic.
So how do you apply that to your teaching in improv?
Well, I'll do it just kind of, you know, as a mechanical exercise. I'm like, great, let's find something you're excited about. Now I want you to talk about it. Now and then I'll talk them through it. I'm like, okay, so you've gone from interest to excitement to euphoria.
Let's do it right now, okay?
Let me pull up the wheel.
We're pulling up the wheel. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm going to pull up the
wheel. This is almost like a little special bonus thing that they get, because usually we end the episode, but this is so fascinating. I think
it was a huge breakthrough, and the couple groups I worked with in L.A. really took to it. One group even printed it on business cards that they handed out for their shows just because they wanted everyone to see it and know it.
Why are we afraid to do emotions in improv, do you think?
Well, because if you fail, then it's you, and you've shown who you are as a person, and you failed as a person. It wasn't that the character wasn't funny. It's like, oh, the guy with the limp wasn't funny. It was the guy who was crying or you know, vulnerable. And we don't want to be vulnerable. A lot of things in Los Angeles, too, people want to be so cool on stage. I go, you can't be Captain America, man. You know, that's for Chris Evans to do. You know, we're going to be the people who suffer and we get shit on and pissed on. And you got to love to be shit on and pissed on. You know, we're enduring stuff. And those are the, that's comedy. So it's a huge shift because people move out to be the funny.
And,
the,
you know, I try to teach vulnerability in classes. Why is it important in comedy? Why is vulnerability important in comedy? People ask me that question all the time. And sometimes I don't have the answer.
I think this came out through Shuli in opening night. We could not show, we could not express misogyny any or whatever, you know, just emotions by how crushed she was or defeated by something that somebody else did. And by her being vulnerable, it made the aggressors look horrible. Do you know what I mean? So by being vulnerable, we're able to show how impactful thoughts are or, you know, everything is.
So you guys were doing a scene where the characters were misogynistic.
Yeah. Or let's say, I mean, it was even just, you know, not even to blanket it as misogyny. It was just someone's being a jerk.
Okay.
She'd just be so hurt on a date or taken aback or someone spoke over her. And the way that it was done was just like, oh, man, it was so powerful in the way she did it. It made the other guy look like an even bigger prick. You know,
but isn't she representing the audience?
Yeah, in a way. But here's the thing, though. Our gut action would be, hey, you spoke over me.
Right.
You talked over while I was talking. That's not going to achieve the same thing. By her having that level of hurt, now us in the audience, oh, my gosh, that was really impactful. Instead of her fighting back, like, oh, well, she's feisty and whatever
But
else.
That's people's tendency. When mm-hmm. somebody comes strong and acts a jerk, I'm going to act the jerk, too.
Yeah, but that's not life.
Right.
Yeah.
And so really, a good way to play it is if someone comes on strong, you know, go to the low stage.
Yeah, I mean, watch some of the best, you know, comedian. I mean, you watch everyone walk through the world, like Mr. Bean, like if you know, whatever you want to say about Rowan Atkinson, but the whole world is high status to that guy. Mm-hmm. You know, everything's vexing or perplexing. He doesn't even talk. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, how much power does a turkey sitting on a table have? It's going to ruin that guy's life mm-hmm. because he allows himself to be dominated by it. So allow yourself to be dominated and the audience will go to your side and they'll see how powerful a turkey just sitting on a table is or whatever the thing.
All right, we got the wheel of emotions.
Yeah, I've got the wheel of emotions
okay,
out.
So what do you want to start with?
Pick a color, Jimmy. What color do you like?
Red.
Red. Okay. So your first feeling is annoyance. So think of something that just kind of annoys you, even mildly.
Having to pick up my daughter. She's 2 years old, and my back hurts. And
yeah,
she's
just
like,
keep going.
She keeps, you know, she's, you know, like, oh, pick me up. But I'm like, I gotta come
good,
here.
Let that go into anger.
I gotta come here to interview you, and I'm like, you know, what the fuck? I don't have time for this.
Into rage.
And the thing is, it's like I don't understand why she needs it right now. You know, it's like, and I want to say to my wife, you know, like, why don't you fucking do it? You know, you fucking do it. Why do I have to do it?
Good.
You know.
And that's pretty much it. So all of it is just like taking something small as picking your daughter up, and it takes you to rage.
All right, give me one more, and a positive one. Because
a positive one. Oh, yeah. I mean, like,
that's the hardest
that's not
one
human.
For
yeah, you're yeah. Like, oh, what a dick of a
right.
dad.
Right.
Let's do something that distracts you. I kind of brought this one up before.
Distracts me. Right now,
yeah.
I mean, it's, I you know, there's birds out there. And it's,
yeah, okay,
you know,
great.
And I'm trying
good,
to
now
do
you're surprised
interviews.
By them.
Oh my God! It's oh my God! It's a raven.
Yeah.
In the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah.
In
straight into amazement.
Oh my God! I haven't seen a raven. You know what that means? You know what a raven means? That means good luck. That means like
yeah.
this is going to be
good.
Like this.
So that's it. So then that's also too like you know like shiny things. Like I think we are distracted by things that we are surprised and amazed by on a very small level. So that's just kind of taking it to the next degree.
So how would you apply this to doing a scene?
So. So if the suggestion or whatever it was something that distracted you, you start to kind of learn yourself in those, mm-hmm. you know, those emotional states where like, oh, look at that watch. That's a really nice watch. Whoa, somebody's been doing well. And now I'm amazed by you. And now I have a relationship with you too, just that I was amazed by your watch
mm-hmm.
and what kind of a person you are.
Mm-hmm.
So from that small thing, from me just being distracted by your watch.
It's a Rolex.
Yeah, I've now built up a character. Now you have
yeah.
something else too that
yeah.
you can take from that. But it's just kind of, again, having those moments, whatever that is, or I'm annoyed by this. And just being really honest with yourself, like, oh, how did I feel about picking my kid up?
Mm-hmm.
I was annoyed by it. And that's going to fucking take me to rage.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. And it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think what's cool about it is it's this, because you do. I know I've done it as a teacher. I'm like, get to a 10, get to a 10,
mm-hmm.
get to a 10. And a lot of times it shuts people down.
Yeah.
But this is almost a map of the emotion.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a little arc to it. And we respond to that. We know arcs. We are, as a society, very hardwired to... identify arcs.
And do you think that's why forms work so well? Because people kind of know the beginning, middle, and end to it, and mm-hmm. they feel safe?
Yeah, absolutely. And as a Western culture, too, I mean, like, we're very satisfied with certain kinds of endings that they aren't in Australia or other countries. Like, you watch movies in Australia, it's like, that third act is always devastatingly depressing in a comedy. You know what I mean? It's like, and that's the kind of thing that I'm looking forward to in England, too. It's like, stories don't go the same way. And it's like, I had a friend direct a series in England, like, you don't say I love you to another character. You cannot do that, because English people do not say I love you to each other. You know, they have to say, oh, it's in the song lyric, I think I love you, you know, by the Partridge Family. I'm not saying it, but the song lyric said it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Great. We got to wrap this up.
I know. We went
along.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you.
We could go on forever. Yeah. And good luck in England.
Thank you.
Anything you're afraid of?
No, it's like anytime I think I'm scared, I'm like, no, you've already done that before. Like anything, you know, it's like you've gotten over that hurdle. So you don't know what the hurdles are till you get there. You know, it's like having a kid. Everyone says, all you can prepare for is for the first night. Because then you meet your kid, and then everything is dictated by what they need.
Did you have this experience having a kid? We did. I didn't fall in love with Betsy, my daughter, immediately. The first 6 months were like, what did we do?
Yeah. I was on the other end. I was full. I was in. But it took my wife a minute to kind of come around. And it does a lot of times for women, too. You know, the postpartum kind of a thing. And that was frustrating for her. She's like, you are so into this. And I'm not. And that caused guilt. And, you know, and then you figure it all out. And now he's the best thing on the planet.
One night my wife came in. She said, this was maybe 4 months into it. She said, if I didn't care what people thought, I'd give her away. And a lot of people would say, well, it's the dad, because the dad's not connecting. But I think the in some cases, the mom struggles with that.
Oh, man, and they're not given credit for that at all. And it's a hormonal shift, and uh-huh. it's a life change. And, man, when Deb started expressing a little bit of concern about that stuff postpartum, everyone came out of the woodwork. And like, oh, me too, and mm-hmm. I had that feeling. And, you know, because it's a wrong emotion to have, or yes. a wrong feeling. Fuck that. It's mm-hmm. real, and it exists. Like, okay, cool, how do we get around it? The discussion of postpartum depression, you know, is it's so disgusting how it's distorted and placed in society. And we just need to have an open dialogue that, yes, it fucks up your world. It's nothing. It's not perfect. It's sloppy. It's not what, you know, the honest company wants us to think it is, you know. So
why I got you on this subject, yeah. jealousy. Yeah. I think jealousy is a very interesting one, because people don't want to admit that either.
Oh, that they're jealous of other stuff?
Yeah, because it's not about them. If I'm jealous of Tina Fey or anyone who started in Chicago, mm-hmm. it's not about them. It's about me. Why are people afraid to admit that?
That they're jealous?
Yes.
I don't know. I'm not, though.
How did you do that?
Early on, I think I told you this earlier. When I was a young actor, I was hanging around guys who were very successful, and they bitched and complained about their careers all the time. And what their life was like, and how they had to go fly out of town. And then, you know, the old adage was, the only thing worse than a non-out-of-work actor was a working actor. And I'm like, I never want to be like that. I never want to bitch and complain about my career. Obviously, I have. There's times when things suck. But for the most part, I go, everybody's kind of going through their own bullshit. Nobody's happy. Everybody's looking for the next level. Even if I talked to Brian Austin Green, there were some days where he thought everything's fucked and his career's like, I'm like, well, why am I jealous of somebody else who's not 100% happy? Nobody's 100% happy. All I can control is what my life is and my journey. And that's why leaving was easier, too. It's like, my friend said, what else did you want to achieve? You've done 3 series. You're in a blockbuster movie. You've done 100 commercials. What else is on your checklist? And I was like, you know what? You're right. I can kind of leave happy. I could have gotten one more show. I could have gotten a network sitcom that ran for 8 years. But who knows? But did I do what I want to do? Pretty much. I did a lot more than probably 90% of the people who go out to Los Angeles to be an actor.
Yeah, you're very, very successful.
Well, I don't know about... I'm happy. I'm very lucky. And I think that...
Well,
yeah.
Break a leg in Los Angeles, because that's what we say, right? We don't... We can't wish you good luck.
Thank you.
You're going to do great out there.
Thank you. And this was so great. I love the podcast, and I was beyond thrilled to be here.
Derek Miller, thank you so much for being our guest on this episode of Improv Nerd.
Thank you, Jimmy.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd. Derek Miller brought it. And I love the exercises we did, because I really got a ton out of it. So thank you, Derek Miller, for being our guest. And thank Derek Miller's dad for allowing us to tape this episode in Derek Miller's dad's house. Also, I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, I'd like to say, follow us on the different social media outlets we have found ourselves on over the years, like Facebook. Go and like the Improv Nerd fan page, because it really helps with my low self-esteem, and on Twitter, improv_nerd. Also, subscribe to our Improv Nerd YouTube channel, where we have clips from our either our live shows or when we're interviewing somebody, and that's Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. I want to thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, walk, don't run. Nerd is a nerd.